Good morning and welcome to Veterans Voice. Today with me is Mr. Bill Byers, and I don't know where John is.
I hope he's all right. Yeah. John, if you're okay, give us a sign.
Give us a sign. We got a sign up here. No us. Don't say it.
We're not saying.
And we're not going to say it. We're going to be speaking today with Christian Appy. Christian Appy is a professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's written probably what I think is the best book on the American War in Vietnam. It's called Working Class War: American Combat Soldiers and Vietnam by Christian G. Appy. It is the best book about soldiers, American soldiers, in Vietnam. It was written, I think, this book was written, let me look here, Bill.
All right.
I'm not sure when Christian wrote this book. But 1993, he wrote the book in 1993, and it is really, really well documented. Everything in this book is great. If you're a Vietnam vet or related to a Vietnam vet in any way, this book is one of the books that I think that you should get and read. And the other book that Christian wrote, it's another great book. It's called Patriots, The Vietnam War Remembered from All Sides. And it is also a really good book. He wrote that, and he had the help of some friends of ours, Bill.
Is that right?
In Vietnam. Lady Borton and David Thomas.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
They helped him a lot. I got a message back. He said that both Lady and David helped me a lot with the second one, which is Vietnam Remembered from Both Sides. There's going to be a concert called by George Mann in concert. That's Friday the 17th. That's tonight at 9 p.m. at AMF Local 99, the Musicians Union, at 325 Northeast 20th, Portland, Oregon. Benefit concert for the Education Without Borders Veterans Project. Suggested admission $10 to $15, all welcome regardless. And if you need more information on that, you can call Dan at 503-661-1317. And he'll give you any more information that you want to know, that you'll want to know about George Mann in concert, which I think will be a very good concert. And as I do every month when we have our radio show, I go and get the Waragonian newspaper and check on the what page the U.S. deaths from the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. And, Bill, today we've moved up to A4.
Wow.
Yeah, we're on A4.
Must have been a slow day.
Must have been. Right now, 4,273 members of the United States military have died. And this is kind of interesting. They say at least 605 Americans have died in Afghanistan, at least. That's kind of interesting, at least. But we will know. We'll notice. One of the things that's interesting. I talked to a class, Bill, out at Pacific University last week. There must have been 50 kids in that class.
Oh, was there any interest on the campus of
what's going on now?
What's going on now?
Yeah, starting to be a lot more interest on what's going on now.
Our experience earlier on was
Kind of not.
Yeah.
But right now, there's starting to be a lot more interest about what's going on in Iraq, especially Afghanistan. And I, one of the things I wrote on the board was 1,900,000. Then I wrote 58,000. Then I wrote 16,511. And I asked these kids, you know, think Vietnam, 1,900,000. That's the number of Vietnamese that were killed. 58,000 was the number of Americans killed in the whole war, right? And so I says 16,511, and they couldn't figure it out. They couldn't figure it out. And so I finally says, okay, that number is the number of Americans that were killed in 1968. Only in 1968 was 16,511 Americans killed. So if that would have happened, if that would have been the number right now for all of Iraq, there would have been an uprising.
Oh, certainly.
But
certainly.
With, you know, that was just 1 year in Vietnam.
Yeah.
68, 69 was just a little bit lower, you know, but not that much lower.
Yeah.
So 68, 69 was really the high point of the war.
Yeah.
And those kids couldn't believe it. You know, they said 4,000 in Iraq and all this time, and 16,500 died in 1 year in Vietnam. You know, that was kind of interesting to them. And they asked some really good questions, and a lot of them didn't support what was going on in Iraq.
What about the number of wounded from Afghanistan and Iraq?
Yeah, they don't ever talk about that. No. I've never seen any numbers. You know, and they never talk about the number of dead Iraqis.
Africans right now. No.
And that's going to go way up. See, the thing that Bush or even President Obama doesn't understand. In Vietnam, one of the reasons that they could survive, the Vietnamese could survive so long, was that they had so many people up in the north that were willing to go down south and fight. It was like they always had enough people to fight. They could drag the war out for so long, and they knew that the Americans weren't going to, you know, last that long with the death toll going up. And they had this big pool of people to call on.
Yeah.
And Obama's got to think about that in Afghanistan. He's not thinking about that because there's 1 billion Muslims in the world.
Sure.
And there's a high percentage of those Muslims that will go to Afghanistan and fight.
And the Taliban seems to be gaining sort of strength. Legitimacy,
right.
and strength,
right,
and fighting ability.
Yeah, they have enough in reserve to draw that war out for 100 years or more.
Yeah.
And President Obama really has to think about that.
Well, the Russians learned a lesson there.
The British learned a lesson there.
Yeah.
All these guys learned a lesson there. That country is not some country you're going to go into and fight a war and end it soon.
No.
So we're going to say, we have Kristen on the line. And I want to say again, Tammy's got him on the line for us. Thanks, Tammy. Working Class War by Christian Nappy is the best book written about American combat soldiers in Vietnam. The best book written. And Laurel, my wife, is a professor at Pacific University in Forest Grove, and she uses this book in her class, Literature of the Vietnam War. She uses that. And, well, this isn't the one she uses, but the one she uses has all these marks in it where she marks stuff out that she wanted her students to, you know, and she does all this stuff with it. And like I said, the other book that Christian wrote was Patriots, The Vietnam War Remembered from All Sides. And both these books, I'm sure you can get at PALS. In fact, I know I got Patriots from PALS. And Working Class War, I'm not sure where I got it. But it's great. Christian?
Yes. Is this Marvin?
Yeah, this is me.
How you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I'm really glad that you emailed me back, because I've wanted a long time to talk with you about, you know, Working Class War and Vietnam War Remembered from All Sides, because they are the really two great books, Christian.
Well, I appreciate that.
They're great books. And Working Class War, like I just said, Laurel told me to tell you that you're one of her heroes for writing this book, because it is great, and her students really, really like it. So the thing that I emailed you, because in the book it talks about working class, and then it talks about poor.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain the difference, or how you came about using those two different? What's the differences between those two different
well,
names?
This is a little oversimple, but you know, in concrete terms, working class probably means you're living paycheck to paycheck, and maybe struggling in good times to put some of it away for some economic security, and being poor is being mostly flat out broke a lot of the time. And really, it comes down to, you know, resources and employment. I mean, a lot of the real poor kids who went to Vietnam came from broken homes and were, you know, whose parents were underemployed or sometimes unemployed or sporadically employed, and just having a hard time of it. That was probably a smaller portion of the whole group that went to Vietnam than working class. I think about 50 or 60% of the guys that were over there were from working class, meaning guys whose parents worked in factories or were firefighters or were in sales and service or nurses. And I mean, working class is a pretty big category.
Right.
And at the top of it, there's more economic security. And at the bottom, you know, the line between working class and poor can be very fluid. You know, these are not, they're not big fixed boundaries between classes.
People moved in and out of
out of it.
The one I think that in my unit, I was in an infantry unit in 1968, and I would say that, boy, you're right. I'd say probably 70 or 80% of my company were working class, blue collar.
Yeah,
and a lot, and you know, some of them were just flat poor kids.
Yeah,
that couldn't get out of the draft.
Right.
So, one of the things that really interested me, in the book Working Class War, is you went from 66 to 1971, and you went through education.
Mm-hmm.
And that, boy. It's amazing the percentage of the kids with less than 12 years of school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's high.
Yeah.
In 66, it was 22.9.
Mm-hmm.
And then down to, it got a little less, you know, in 71, where it's 14.7.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty high for kids that never went to finished high school.
Yeah, well, one of the things that happened is that when the war escalated, the military began to lower its standards.
Right. And
we can see that happening over the last 8 years.
Yeah.
Where, you know, in the early 60s, maybe 50% of the people that came in to take the qualifying intelligence exam would score in the bottom two quintiles and weren't. Those guys tended not to be drafted, but then 65, 66, as the draft quotas kicked up, they started taking those guys in.
Right.
They even had a project called Project 100,000.
McNamara's 100,000.
McNamara's idea that these guys were actually the poorest of the poor were being discriminated against, and you could get them in the military and train them up and give them the discipline they need, and it would not only serve their country, but would somehow help them. And
right.
In fact, it proved to be a really disastrous program.
Well, yeah, one of the things that they did was they put these guys in combat arms.
Right.
They put them in infantry and, well, probably artillery less than infantry, and then in armor. And the casualty rate for these guys was outrageous.
Yeah.
Outrageous. These guys who could not pass that simple test, Christian, who couldn't join the military or get drafted early on, and then when they lowered the score, they take these guys in and they get them killed. It's just seems unfair, you know, because I knew a couple guys from McNamara's 100,000, and they took them out of the field and put them back in the company back at Campanari,
mm-hmm.
because they weren't safe. They were undisciplined. They weren't safe, and they would put us in, you know, harm's way worse than the lieutenants were doing.
Yeah.
So that was really hard. But the another interesting point that, and you could probably explain this more, is that guys with 1 to 3 years of college, it was pretty low, but it got higher as the war went on. And then guys with 4 more years of college, it also got higher. Can you explain why they did that?
Well, the main reason is they finally got rid of the student deferment, the college deferment. Mm-hmm. That did run until 1971, but between that and also just drafting guys after the after college,
mm-hmm.
The number of college-educated did tend to go up toward the end.
Yeah, but not very much.
But not very much. And then the lottery affected the final years, and that, of course, was a more random, and in theory at least, a fairer way of doing the draft.
Mm-hmm.
But it came so late that it didn't really affect the overall class composition of mm-hmm. the military.
And one thing that I really didn't know, well, I kind of knew but didn't really know, is that early on, they were sending 16- and 17-year-olds to Vietnam.
Well, technically not. I mean, I think some guys did. There was a rule that you weren't supposed to be in country unless you were 18 years old. But, you know, guys did, I think, some number successfully lied about their age. and the military was willing to, you know, go along with it. So I have no doubt that there were some 16- or 17-year-olds who ended up, you know, in country.
Yeah.
Fighting,
you know. That's an awful young age to be in the war, in the war. Do you, you know, with all the work you did doing this book, boy, I tell you what, I hope you won a lot of awards for this book, Christian. I hope you did.
Well, yeah, honestly, very few people get a lot of rewards from writing books. It's not so much the recognition or the money. It's really talking to people like you who read it and for whom it makes you hope some kind of difference. But
yeah,
I mean, you're raising this issue of the class background.
Yeah,
spot in the war. One of the reasons I got interested in this subject is that I grew up just in the wake of this generation, and I turned 18 in 1973, the year the draft ended.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is that I, even though I was pretty sheltered from the war, that very fact was raised my curiosity because I didn't know a single guy in my town, which was this upper middle class suburb, mostly all white. I didn't know a single guy who had gone off to Vietnam. It turns out there were a few from my town, but it, you know, very few.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went off to school and eventually graduate school, I really felt this real curiosity about the generation just a few years older than myself who had both fought the war and protested against it and mm-hmm. you know, really made history.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow, did you... Happy. I want to talk about this a little bit here. How much time did you spend time in Vietnam when you were writing this book?
Not the first one, but with Patriots, which is an oral history.
Yeah.
I did 350 interviews for that, and was able to use about 135 of them in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that involved 4 trips to Vietnam because it includes the accounts not just of Americans but of Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the motivation there was I'd been teaching about the war for many years to undergraduates, and most of what they had heard or seen about the war had come through Hollywood movies like Platoon or Full Metal Jacket, and they were really focused on what they thought the war did to us, you know, the
right.
United States, and what a tragedy it was for us, which in many ways it was.
Mm-hmm.
But they had very little sense of what we had, the effect on Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
what it was like for the Vietnamese. So that was really the motivation for trying to do a book about the war that really was much more inclusive.
Mm-hmm. And how did did you finance your trips to Vietnam and to write Patriots?
Oh, well, I was lucky enough to get a publisher's advance, which helped pay for those trips, though I ripped through it pretty quickly, I have to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was relying a lot on my spouse's income at that point while I was working on that book.
And where did you start, in Hanoi or down south?
Every trip I sort of traveled around, both in the north and the south.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how did you meet Lady?
Oh, Lady Borden?
Yeah.
You know, I had met her through University of Massachusetts in Boston, where every summer they have a writing workshop that she and a number of other people have connections to the Vietnam War participated in. And I met her there, and she, because she had so many contacts in Vietnam, she helped introduce me to some people when I went over there.
Yeah, she's like this national hero over there. I mean, everywhere Lady goes, they know who she is.
Yeah, well, she's, you know, she's fluent in Vietnamese.
Oh, perfect Vietnamese. And she was there, you know, early on in the war. I mean, she stayed there and worked out in the... She was the first person that the Vietnamese farmers went to right after the My Lai massacre.
Right.
Because that's the area she was working at for the American Foreign Service Committee.
Yeah, right.
And so Lady knows a whole lot about that.
Yeah.
And then you said you know our good friend David Thomas.
That's right. Yeah, he was a veteran in an engineering unit in the Central Highlands during the war, but then became an artist and began traveling back to Vietnam in the 1980s and establishing relationships with Vietnamese artists and has done some great work putting together art exhibits of both art done by American veterans of the war and Vietnamese veterans of the
war. Yeah, he also made that really great book about Ho Chi Minh.
Right.
Have you seen that book?
Yeah, I have seen that.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it really is.
Wow, it's a great book. Great book. So when you were, how did you decide which people to interview? For the, you said you had like 300 or something.
Yeah.
How did you break it down?
I kind of made a wish list of different types of people I wanted to interview. So ranging from, you know, ordinary soldiers on all sides to generals on both sides, including this, not just the Viet Cong in the South and the North Vietnamese Army, but the South Vietnamese military and government types, and journalists, medical people, anti-war activists. Once I sort of made that list of categories, then I would try to meet people, and once you kind of got your a few connections in those circles, people, you know, I'd always ask for tips and leads, and that would lead you to another person and another person, and by the time I was sort of a few years into it, I had list of, you know, far more people than I could ever possibly interview.
Yeah, let's talk about the Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
When you interviewed a Viet Cong, out of all of those, who really impressed you the most?
Well, actually, it was a woman. Tran Thi Gung, last name in Vietnamese means gentry, and I remember meeting her in Ho Chi Minh City, and a very, as many Vietnamese women are, petite. I don't think she could be more than about 4'11". I remember she was sitting in a chair, and I sort of looked down, and her toes were barely touching the ground.
Yeah,
and yet she had fought in the jungles in and around Cu Chi for about 7 years, starting in about 63, and was the only woman in her unit, but clearly had experienced an enormous amount of combat. And among other things, they had her do, she did a lot of dangerous reconnaissance missions to sneak inside bases of the, often the South Vietnamese army bases, and gather information. And one of the missions, I remember she said it was so dangerous that her commander was completely convinced that she would die, so her unit held what they called a funeral mass for the living. mm-hmm. in advance of her mission to kind of honor her in the expectation that she would die.
Yeah.
So she said, you know, they talked about me as if I were already dead, and they listed my accomplishments and her awards. But from her, you got a real sense not just of the physical sacrifice of it all. I mean, she once got buried in a bunker. A lot of the times they're in and out of the, you know, Kuchi,
the
site of all these underground tunnels that had been constructed going all the way back to the days of the war against the French, but really got improved and deepened during what they call the American War, of course. And some of them had three levels, and they had hospitals and storage bunkers, and actually could be remarkably safe, sometimes, you know, even under B-52s, which is incredible,
mm-hmm.
unless there was a direct hit. And she once was, as I say, buried for about 7 days in these tunnels. So she had some horrific experiences, but, you know, from her you do get a real sense of how deeply committed they were to their cause. It was, in American terms, it was like a combination of the American Revolution and World War II.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And her father had been killed by government troops, so there was a personal kind of a personal edge to it, too, which there often was, you know.
Yeah, always.
Wanting to get back at it. And, you know, American military policy could be so indiscriminate. One of the arguments I make in Working Class War is I think we did as much to recruit communist forces as the communists did
mm-hmm.
by our policy of
indiscriminate bombing
and creation of free fire zones and the use of napalm and chemical defoliants. Mm-hmm. And,
we seem to be repeating that in Iraq.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Is this
name Bill?
Bill.
Yeah.
Oh,
he's a Korean War vet, and he's also an atomic vet.
Uh huh.
Yeah, we're talking to Christian Appy, who has written what I consider the best book on American soldiers in Vietnam, called Working Class War, and his newest book that I've read. Is Patriots, the Vietnam War, Remembered on All Sides, your newest book?
Yep.
And I got them, I'm pretty sure I got them both at PALS, so you can get them at PALS. I wanted to jumping back and forth to both books, because I've read them both, and they're, do you... You know, all the stuff that you've got, we've always came up with the average age was 19. Do you believe that, of American soldiers?
I actually think now the evidence looks like it was a little bit higher than that. But, mm-hmm. you know, certainly for enlisted personnel, that's not far off.
Right.
Yeah.
Especially with the first part of the war, I think probably it was...
Yeah, it may have, you know, overall bounced up to a little bit over 20, but it's still, compared to World War II, I mean, which was more like 26
right.
something.
And there a was lot real, older,
was
a lot
real
older.
Contrast. Compared to today, where there's much more of a reliance on reserve units,
right.
which tends to raise
the
average age.
Let's talk about black soldiers in Vietnam.
Okay.
Did you find in your working to write the Working Class War, what did you come up with that really surprised you about black soldiers in Vietnam? Or
well,
was there anything?
You know, I think that they have a lot in common in terms of their experience with white soldiers, though. Mm-hmm. The military reflects the divisions of the home front, and mm-hmm. so just as there were a lot of tensions after Martin Luther King
right.
was assassinated and riots in many cities, there were fights and riots and bases over in Vietnam.
So, right, there was. But, you know, there wasn't any, I didn't see any trouble between the blacks and the whites in the field.
Yeah, that's what often is said, you know, by all people, that there really was that kind of camaraderie and solidarity on the front. But, of course, that's sort of based on, you know, being in danger together.
Yeah, right.
Dependent. You take that danger away, and you're back in the rear. You kind of revert to the old division.
Yeah. Because I remember, you know, I had a lot of really good friend black friends in Vietnam, and even with those guys, when we got back into the field, back to like on a stand down or something, that it was almost a complete. Blacks would go with blacks, Hispanics would go with Hispanics, and white guys would go with white guys.
Well, one thing that is important to note about the racial experience of the war is that, and this isn't a great surprise, but in general, black soldiers were much more keenly aware of the racial dimension to the mm-hmm. war and the fact that we were fighting against Asians.
Mm-hmm.
And I vividly remember Wayne Smith, one of the men I interviewed. Actually, he's in Patriots,
mm-hmm.
An African-American medic,
mm-hmm.
the 9th Infantry Division. He said that when he went over to Vietnam, he had made a pledge to himself that as much as he had heard the word gook being thrown around, even in basic training, that he would never allow himself to use that word because he understood that it could just, it really... meant the same as the N-word,
mm-hmm.
or it could be applied to him as well. And but 6 months later in Vietnam, he said that he broke that pledge.
Mm-hmm. This,
for him, it remains one of the really hard memories mm-hmm. of the war. The way it could kind of raise this what he describes as bloodlust
mm-hmm.
For the enemy after being out there and experiencing the combat and taking care of his men.
Mm-hmm.
He really didn't want to fire his weapon, but even as a medic, he did begin to participate in firefighting.
Yeah, my cousin was a combat medic for the AmeriCal,
mm-hmm.
and I asked him about that, and he said that in the AmeriCal division, that medics did the same thing as the infantrymen did, They pulled guard duty at night. They dug foxholes. They were in the foxholes and did, guard, and they did everything. The only thing that they got was when someone got shot, they had to crawl up and fix them.
Mm-hmm.
So, medics were just, same thing we were.
Yeah.
So they had the same feeling.
Yeah.
When you talk to... doggone it, I wasn't going to say that, but because I'm having trouble saying and I don't want to do that. But when you talk to the South Vietnamese soldiers,
yep.
Was there anything that ran through all of them when you talked to them? Was there any distinct feelings or when you talked to them?
Yeah. I hate to generalize too much, but in general, they would say that the minute the Americans really started to escalate and, in effect, take over the war, they knew that they had a really tough case to make to their other Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
They could say, look, if they believed it, I think many fervently did, we don't really want to come under communist leadership in
mm-hmm.
this country, as much as we might want to be a reunified and independent nation, we shouldn't trust the communist.
Mm-hmm.
But their neighbor might say, yeah, okay, you might be right, but at least the communists are Vietnamese, and
Ooh.
You're siding with these Americans.
So
there was that sense that they were kind of tainted by that foreign dependence on foreigners, and of course, every Vietnamese grew up in a culture, and to the present, this is true, that had always honored as the great patriotic heroes of the nation those who had resisted foreign domination going all the way back 2,000 years, in wars against China, which
right.
continued on into the,
The Chung
sisters? The 15th century. and then France, the wars against France.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that... I remember one of the South Vietnamese, he was a young lieutenant who got wounded in the war. He gets at this question by telling a story of how one day he was they were on a mission and they came across a sack of mail, believe it or not, that had worked its way down from the north that was being distributed to North Vietnamese soldiers. And instead of just taking it right into the intelligence unit, he couldn't resist opening up some of it and looking at it. And he said, you know, what the staggering thing is that the letters were so passionate about the cause of the war, and, you know, we miss you and we love you and want you back, but, you know, you're doing the right thing and defending our country. And he said, you know, we never felt that, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of sense of fervor. And in fact, we distrusted a lot of our officers, and we could see the corruption at the top levels, and we were more wanting just to get through this thing and hang on and survive. So mm-hmm. I think that was sort of more typical of the attitude of, you know,
of the South Vietnamese soldier.
Yeah.
We're talking with Christian Appy, who's written two great books, Working Class War and Patriots. And you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. And Bill, you had a question for Christian?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Christian, how much of a role did religion play in the attitude of the South Vietnamese?
Ooh, good question.
Was it able, you know, did that influence their attitude?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Wow.
I don't really have a great answer for
it. Yeah, that's
I mean, it is certainly true that at the top levels of the South Vietnamese government and military, a great many of them had come down from the north, actually, at the time of the what was to have been a temporary division
right.
after the Geneva Accords in 1954. And actually were encouraged to move south by the CIA
and the
Navy to provide a kind of a constituency for the Ngo Dinh Diem, who was a Catholic leader that was put in place by the United States and had actually spent a few years at the Mary Knoll Seminary in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere between 5% and 10% of Vietnamese were Catholic in those years, and that really was an important part of the base of the government. But, you know, among the ordinary troops, draftees in the South, the majority of them, like the country as a whole, would have, if they had a religious convictions, would have been Buddhist.
Yeah, but I read that the desertion rate in the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong was kind of high, but the desertion rate in the South Vietnamese army was really high.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's no question about that, and it was a problem that only got worse, and it fed a kind of corruption. One of the things that would happen is the commanders of different units would often not report desertions, because they would, you know, say a private comes up to him and says, look, I've got a sick relative back at home, I'm going to go visit, and I'll be back in a month or so.
Yeah.
You know, the officer might say, okay, but the reason they might tolerate that is that they might continue to receive the salary for that guy.
Right, exactly. they would take that guy's pay.
Right.
And I'm sure that happened a lot. One of the things I was in Working Class War, the reason for folks going into the war in 1964, draft motivated 37.6%. In 1968, 47.2% went into service because of the fear of the draft.
Right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, people rightly say that more people were volunteers, the majority of people who fought in Vietnam were volunteers, and that's technically true, but about half of those volunteers report, even in military surveys, that they volunteered because they thought that the draft was inevitable.
Yeah,
they might have already even received their draft notice, and they wanted to have a little bit more control over what branch of the service they entered, or just wanted to get it over, because when they go looking for a job, the boss will say, well, have you done your military service yet? Because if you haven't, we really don't want to train you. And so when they felt, you know, it's sort of unavoidable, I better just get it over with.
Right.
Yeah, they were one step ahead of the draft board.
Yeah.
Barely.
I read a definition of war one time, Christian, and it said something to the effect that war is working class people that don't know one another, pitted against one another for some unknown reason.
Yeah.
And they'd be willing to kill one another for some unknown reason. And something else that reminded me during your talk was, that I was reminded of during your talk was, at the end of the Civil War, many of the black soldiers in the Union Army went to the West to kill Indians.
Right.
And you were talking about we're talking about the discrimination and the willingness to Marvin's playing around here. The willingness of people who have been mistreated by their government to do the wishes of their government.
Right.
That's really horrible. I was also I love both books a lot, and I hope lots of people go get them. But Working Class War, just, you know, it's in my blood because that's who I was.
Yeah.
But I was looking, Father's Occupations, Christian.
Yeah.
Of the percentages, blue collar workers, 52.8% in the Army, 54.5% in the Navy, 52% in the Air Force, and 57.2% of all the troops were blue collar.
Right.
And one of the interesting points in this is military, kids of military, 1.8% in the Army, 2.1% in the Navy, 1.8% in the Air Force, and 2% in the Marine Corps. What does that tell you?
What it tells me is that we've been taught that this is a classless society, and people don't view themselves in that regard.
Yeah.
And as Christian mentioned earlier, they're one paycheck ahead of the poor farm.
Yeah.
But we don't have any classes in this country. You know, we don't have a class of working people or a class of office workers or administrators. We're all the same.
We're supposed to be middle class.
Yeah, right.
Ask that to all these folks that are going to the unemployment office right now, if there's a class system in this country.
Right.
You ask those folks. And the military today is, especially right now, Christian, I was reading in the paper where right now a lot of these folks are re-enlisting in the military because there's no jobs on the outside.
Right. And because they're offering big recruitment bonuses.
Yeah, yeah.
Possibility of education. And,
right.
You know, I think what you were referring to earlier about the willingness of soldiers just to serve a government, even if they're sort of naive about the reality they might face, I mean, that was something that really struck me in interviewing veterans of Vietnam. And people would candidly talk about how street smart they were in some ways, you know, about local life and what it was like in their community or in their street corner or in their family, and they knew how rough it could be, you know.
Yeah.
Father might be really the mean guy who knows, or your boss, but they were, as these guys told me, really innocent about the government as a whole, in part because of the experience of World War II. You know, they just sort of grew up assuming that the military and the government wouldn't do them wrong.
We learned pretty fast over there, Christian, that somebody was lying to us. We learned that pretty fast. Even being, you know, poor kids, we learned that really fast.
Yeah, you could get all, I mean, you just land in country, right? And you're wondering, well, if this is supposed to be helping these people and we're saving them, why isn't there more of a welcoming committee?
Yeah, we got out, we landed at Long Bin or Benoit, I can't remember, and got on these buses that had chicken wire over the windows.
Right.
You know, and wow, if we're here to help these guys, how come, you know, who they're protecting us from, you know?
Right.
So I thought that was crazy. You talked to, in Patriots, you talked to Oliver Stone.
That's right. That's
talk
right.
about him.
Well, he's an interesting character. I mean, my impression of him is that, on the one hand, he really does deeply object to the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. and rightly considers himself an anti-war activist of a kind, but he also has a pretty obvious and deep-seated streak of, what would you call it, I don't know, just sort of macho
thing.
And he kind of wants to have a little bit both ways, to be kind of a war hero and an anti-war hero.
There's a lot of them out there.
So he was throwing around the F word all over the place as he described his war experiences. Mm-hmm. And what's different about Stone from a lot of guys is he actually did come from this very privileged background.
That's what I wanted to say.
His father was a big Wall Street guy, and he had gone to Yale and mm-hmm. dropped out of Yale to first go into the Merchant Marine and then on into mm-hmm. the Army.
What was interesting that I'd never heard about Oliver when I read your book was that he had gone to Vietnam before he'd gone into the military.
That's right. That's right. He did some.
He went over as a teacher,
teaching some English language. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He went. He was in Vietnam before the American buildup to the war, or before he was even in the military.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, one positive thing about him is at least he is a filmmaker of ours who has really at least addressed this huge subject of the Vietnam War in several films. So mm-hmm. while I have quibbles about the films themselves, I mean, it's important that we can, that filmmakers continue to try to grapple with it, because I mm-hmm. still don't think, after all these years and all these books and movies, that we've really had anything like a full reckoning of the
Well, your book.
And damage that war did.
Your book, Working Class War. Now, I'm telling you, man, it's great.
Thanks.
It's great. Yeah. The one thing, I have a friend, I just went back last year to visit Vietnam again, and I went with a good friend of ours, Willie Jin. And Willie Jin was in the 25th Infantry Division. He's a Chinese-American. And he was in that battle that Stone used, at the end of his movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And Willie was in that battle, and he talks about it. Yeah, he talks about it.
It's interesting. There's another guy who was in that battle whose account is in Patriots, named Larry Heineman.
Right, Larry. Right, yeah. Right, right. And Willie says that it was, pretty interesting.
that
he knew Stone. He had met Oliver Stone before.
Yeah.
And he had met Oliver Stone. But Willie was, I started going back to Vietnam in 94, and the trip I went with Willie was, I enjoyed it a lot, Christian. I enjoyed it because I know so many people there over the years. I've been going back to Vietnam. But it
give us a